Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. This is Advanced Design for Engineers, and really glad to have you here. Design's often broken into, two components, form and function, and this talk is no different. We're going to have Christian Robinson presenting on form, and he designed the Roboto typeface. And I'm going to present on function, on interactive design. And I got to work on Google Now, which launched yesterday. So as you can imagine, I'm incredibly tired. being engineers, you guys know how launching software is and making sure everything's perfect in the end. But while I am physically incredibly tired, I am extremely excited to be able to give this talk. The thing I love more than actually doing interactive design is teaching it. So it's really exciting to get a room of incredibly smart people and to provide all this information to you. So let's dive into interactive. So now this is a room of engineers, I'm assuming. Raise your hand if you're an engineer. Yep, okay. So often engineers don't have a tremendous amount of respect for design. And it's not that they don't think design's important. They realize it's critical to the success of their application. But the reason they disrespect it is it's not controllable in the way that software is normally controllable in hardware. Because you're dealing with people, and people can be kind of random. So because you can't control the people, you feel like, I'll spend more attention on the things that I can control, the execution time, the amount of storage being used, if it's crashing or not, if it's reproducible. And it's not entirely true that people aren't controllable, because really what we're fundamentally dealing with is two information processing machines. And that's, of course, the CPU and the brain. And in some ways, they're very similar. They're both doing computation. One parallel processing, the other one massively parallel. One's base 2, the other one's based on action potential, so you have dramatically more computational power. But where they start to be different is we know exactly how computers work. We can go back and talk to a lot of the people that were kind of instrumental in the field. It hasn't been that long. So computer scientists, there's things they're still discovering about how to make things efficient, but it's not like there's any part of the machine we don't understand yet. Whereas if you talk to someone doing neuroscience or cognitive science, you say, how does the brain work? They have to kind of shrug and say, we're still trying to figure that out. And that's okay. Like, we don't have to have a complete knowledge of how the brain works to still have predictable results. There's enough that we understand about it that we can rely on to get those predictable results. So for the purpose of this talk, it's really kind of dehumanizing, where we're going to treat people like information processing machines. And you might think, well, no, I'm a special snowflake. And yes, you are. But you're also, for the purpose of this talk, a uniform snow processing machine. So three aspects of a great interface. First, it needs to be self-describing. Secondly, you need to prevent errors. And then third, make users fast. So we're going to dive into each of these. So starting out, self-describing. The first thing I want to talk about is this notion of mental model. And a mental model is basically, it's a simulation of reality inside of your mind. So to pose a question, how many instances of this talk are happening right now? And of course, the answer is one. It's right there. The photons are bouncing off the screen at you. And when you're in a big room, you've got the talk there, and that's reality. But then on another side, you have the fact that everyone is interpreting the talk in a simulation of the room inside their own head. So you have, all these simulations going on. And these are the mental models they're building of the reality around them. So, this is very sort of, dystopian movie. Maybe we're all in our little pods and we don't know it. But what's important about this is when you're dealing with interface design, you're not necessarily designing reality as much as you're designing the simulation. You're designing how people are going to think about your application and how they're going to interpret it and if they're going to understand things. So, looking at this just in terms of, a quick diagram, you have the implementation, which, of course, you're incredibly familiar with. Then you have the interface, which is how that implementation manifests itself. Well, what's really important is the mental model, the simulation of the interface inside the user's head. This is something Alan Cooper writes a lot about in his early work. And of course, you have this fourth component, which is the manual. And often, the manual likes to take the blame. In email lists or talking to engineers, it's not uncommon to run into, read the fracking manual as kind of the explanation of why this doesn't work. And just passing the blame forward, if you don't want to blame the manual, you can always blame the users, which, maybe they're stupid, maybe they didn't get it. Like, that's why it failed. And I would argue that it's really not about the intelligence of the user. So to quickly make that argument, let's say we take four geniuses. We'll just select, Einstein, Turing, Eric Schmidt, and you. And we're going to run a lot of experiments, so we're going to need clones. So we start cloning all these guys, and we put them in our deep underground lair. And now clones are really expensive, so we're going to have to keep them safe. So we're going to put them in a room like this. And the rooms, it's to protect them because clones are expensive, but it's also to protect them from any external information. We want to have total control over this experiment, right? So every day we bring them into a testing chamber, looks like this, and we start to teach them. We start to teach them about the world. We go over, various things like, traffic lights, common things that people are going to encounter, maybe turtles. You get the general idea, right? And then once we've got that baseline knowledge of what we expect them to have encountered in the world, like we're not going over any, theoretical physics or anything, like just baseline knowledge, then we start running our experiments, and here's where it gets fun. So we show them, a screenshot, and we say, okay, looking at this thing you've never seen before, what does that button do? And can they get it? Can they get it right? Even though they don't have access to anything other than what they're seeing right here. And they're starting to think, the curvature is very similar to the arc of the thing that's next to it. It's visually lighter, so it feels like it's sort of not there, like the other thing is there. There's only one of these, and it's just the side. So, they might not know for sure, but they might start to guess. I bet it creates another one. Just the way that it's shaped, the way that it's placed, conveys those types of things. Or another example, this one harder. We say, okay, what does HTTPS stand for? And there's no way they're going to get this right, because we didn't tell them, right? It's jargon. It's an acronym they're not going to get. But it's green. We did teach them about traffic lights. And it's next to a lock, a metaphor. So even if they don't get it totally right, its sort of placement and the various things that it conveys, then they might get close enough to say, well, it's probably means that this is better somehow. So they're able to bootstrap conceptually just up enough. Or another example, this one more visual. And we bring them in and we say, what does this application do? And they're going to say, it's very pretty. And then they're going to say, I don't know. Because while this icon is pretty, also, I think, did you work on this one?
Not me.
All right. For the designer in the room who worked on this, I'm sorry, it's a great icon. But it does not convey to the user in this test chamber with access to no other knowledge what it actually does. It is a great application, though. It's shipped on all the devices that you guys have. You should check it out. I use it every day. This is Currents. What does this app do? They're not going to know. So I would argue that success in these situations, it doesn't have to do with their intelligence. It has to do with access to information. Is that information embodied in the thing that they're using? So, quickly you're thinking, all right, well, what if I don't have this, underground testing facility? That sounds really expensive. And it's true. And this is controversial. It's especially controversial for any user researchers in the room. But I would argue, or user researchers watching later, I'd argue, while it's really, really useful to have access to user researchers, you don't absolutely have to rely on them. You could just start running user tests in your own head, basically a short-term amnesia. What you have to do is you have to kind of encapsulate your mind. You have to start thinking, forgetting the things that you know about your interface. Try to look at it with fresh eyes. Try to think, okay, I've never seen this thing before, which is hard because you have seen it before, really, really hard. But if you can do that, if you can look at it with fresh eyes and try to have all of the assumptions fall away that you've already built up, then you're able to do that kind of user test just on yourself quickly right then. And if you're just regularly doing that, it's going to really improve your applications. I think this is one of the most important things that I can convey. But, obviously you're going to be more familiar with the underlying implementation because you are literally building it. In the case of the clock, you are probably intimately familiar with each of the gears and how they fit together and all these details. But you have to just let that fade away. You have to think about, okay, just the interface. Is the interface conveying the right things? And then beyond the interface, the mental model. How is the user simulating this in their head? What information are they getting out of it? So, back to the diagram, letting that implementation fade away. So that's self-describing. At least that's talking about if something should be self-describing. But how do you pull that off? It's one thing to say it's important. It's another thing to tell you literally how to do it. So there's at least five ways. The first one is consistency. And this is cheating, basically. It works great, but it's also kind of a tautology to say, hey, if I design something just like things that the user already knows, they're going to know how to use it. That is true. You do not have to rely on this entirely, though. In fact, Google products are often very different from what's already in the marketplace, and they still are able to bootstrap knowledge from users and have them figure it out. I mean, in case of Gmail, it was sort of a radical reimagination of how email interfaces worked, but it still worked. So, and also, if everyone did consistency all the time, we wouldn't see dramatic innovation in interfaces. So it's, you know, we're not going to focus on this one too much. Basically, it's really useful, and you can guarantee that users are going to understand your application if you focus on consistency, but it's not the only way. So the second one is affordances. Let's go back to the test chamber, and let's say one day they encounter this, and they've never seen it before, and they're thinking, whoa, that's really interesting. This might actually be a way out of the test chamber. And then, you know, how are they going to figure that out? Everything about this design is designed to convey what it does. The way that the door is recessed from the frame, the curvature of the handle, the way that you can kind of just imagine that handle rocking in. You might not know, like, on which side of the door it's going to open, and you might not know what the words mean, but the picture sure looks like yourself, and it seems to be going through it. But that's sort of cheating. Just the physical design of this has been very carefully crafted so that when you look at it, you understand what it's going to do. You understand that you need to push on it. And this is a type of thing that we do just throughout the day, constantly, where, you know, you encounter stuff, and you have to look down and say, oh, I'm going to push on that. It's just this kind of thing that cognitively you're just constantly doing without really even thinking about it. And that's called an affordance. And it's not just in the real world, but also in the physical world. All of these various widgets have these physical properties that are baked into their visual design. When you look at one of these, you can very quickly infer how you're going to interact with it because of those properties. The way that the circle is slightly larger makes it seem grabbable. The way that it's brighter on one side implies that it's been sort of filled, so it feels like a track that you can sort of grab this thing and move it on. Seeing a checkbox, a square in the presence of one that has a checkbox, is going to convey that that one could also have a checkbox. On and off, literally writing it on the switch is going more towards the direction of being, you know, writing your manual on top of it, but the visual design conveys what it does. Same with the button. So these are all affordances. Basically, an affordance is implied physics from the visual appearance. Moving on to the second one, or the third one, natural mapping. So let's run a quick experiment on the audience. Say we're looking at a stove. So the second dial, which burner does it control? And silence, you don't know. Because there's no way to figure it out. We could literally write the glyphs on top of it. That would help. But the thing is, you know, writing your manual directly on the product is cheating. Then, you know, what if it wears off? You know, it's definitely one way of doing it, but it's not a natural mapping. A better UI, and this is something that Alan Cooper likes to talk about, is if the dials were in the same configuration as four things, then it just naturally affords which burner they control. This is also always true of light switches. So light switches only are frustrating when they don't actually map in order to the lights in the room. And if they do map in order, you usually just flip the right one without even thinking about it. If they don't, then you start, you know, randomly hitting them to try to figure it out and getting frustrated. So this is a natural mapping. Another example, controls in a car. I love this one because it's actually two natural mappings at the same time. The first is it's directly below the window. So it's a sort of natural orientation to where the window is. And also the four controls map to the four windows in the car. Sometimes these are placed on the center console, which is really weird. And that's, you know, physical world. In terms of the virtual world, we have things like this, where the full screen control has a natural mapping to the window becoming larger. It's placed on the edge. It seems to afford expanding. In this case, the account selector has a mapping to the window, because the account controls the window as a whole, not an individual tab. So that's natural mapping. Basically, natural mapping is correctly abstracted layout. But even better than natural mapping is direct manipulation. So especially in touch interfaces, you don't want to have abstraction if you don't need it. You don't necessarily need little close buttons on things because you're able to literally directly touch the interface, whereas if, you know, in the world of mice and keyboards, you had to have this type of abstraction. So, you know, for instance, closing an open application on Android, you're just swiping it away, just as you would get rid of something in the real world. And that's a, you know, consistent affordance throughout the platform. And so going back to the stove example, what would direct manipulation of a stove burner look like? This is, of course, kind of curious, because now the dial is the burner, and it's going to light on fire. But you can imagine, like, maybe some kind of gesture, or like, ah, you know, you create fire, or you put it out, you know. It would be at least very exciting. And you'd never be confused over which dial, because you would have direct gestural control over the burner. So that's the fourth one, direct manipulation. No abstraction, you actually act on the objects themselves. And then the fifth one is metaphor. So a metaphor shows up a lot in application icons. Basically what you're trying to do is you're trying to bootstrap off of something the user's seen, either in the real world or in the sort of introductory phase of our crazy experiment. So things like, you know, telephones, maps, you know, various real-world objects helps kind of frame them and you know, ground them in something in reality to explain what the application does. And you don't have to go too far with this. I mean, it's enough to just kind of give them the cue as opposed to having, like, you know, stitching or something in your application, unless you want to do that because you think it looks nice. You don't have to be super literal, but at least, you know, draw that kind of distinction of this is the object that I'm conveying to you. And it's not just application icons, but also it's sometimes more fundamental things. Like, you know, we're just used to having a light source which is above us. You know, the sun just shining in the sky all the time, and the way that conveys light. So when you see a button, that light source is conveying to you that this thing is convex and you can make it concave. It looks like you can push it in. So it's just that kind of quick interactive affordance that you're getting through your experience with the real world, through that sort of metaphor. And also not just small widgets, but large ones. You know, a tab, if you have that sort of same curvature and angle, people are going to be immediately thinking of sort of physical folders they've seen in the real world. So major structural components are going to be part of your interface as well. So metaphor is basically abstract consistency. So that was the five parts about making it self-describing. So let's move on to the next one, which is preventing errors. So the first one I want to talk about is mode errors. Obviously, engineering audience. So how many people think VI is better than Emacs? Actually, not that many. All right. Emacs versus VI, better. Anyway, so VI has a tremendous number of mode errors because you are in either insertion mode or command mode. And I say it has the mode errors because you could blame the user. I mean, it is their job to maintain state in their head of what's going on. But, you know, maybe they got an email or something. You know, things are distracting them. They're thinking about their day. And next thing you know, they're entering commands when they wanted to be entering text. It's a classic example of mode error. Another example, you know, you're in your car, put the car in reverse, you know, check some messages, then floor it. You know, like you don't have that mental state of what mode the car was in right then. Or even just, you know, if your garage door is up or down, the occasional mode error. So to avoid these, you want to make sure that your application doesn't have modes unless absolutely necessary. And if you do have a mode, there's a couple ways to fix it. If you have a mode where the user is actually actively doing something, it's considerably more useful. So like keyboard shortcuts, you have that muscle memory of sort of pushing the key in as you're in the command mode once the keyboard shortcut accelerator is invoked. So you're not going to have mode errors because you're actively doing something. If you have a very strong visual change on the screen during a mode, you know, imagine you know, there was something obvious to indicate this was in command mode, that would help. But generally speaking, you want to try to avoid modes as much as possible because otherwise you're going to have mode errors. Next one, reasonably obvious, data loss. It's often the user's fault. You want to protect them from themselves. Google Docs does a really good job with preventing data loss where it's reasonably hard to lose data with Google Docs. You have to sort of type the most important thing in the world, pull the Ethernet cable, and knock the computer off a cliff, like all in one gesture. And it's hard. Android phones, also really useful. Where you know all the data on the phone is going to be backed up into the cloud and secured in your account. So you're not going to lose all of that really important information. So that's just some examples of preventing data loss. Also really important as people move between devices to have access to information. Those are major cases. Also, you have to worry about minor data loss, which is you did a change and you want to undo it. It is really important to support undo across all the various actions in your application to help prevent users from making these mistakes. So that covers preventing errors. Now, finally, making users fast. This is, you know, obviously speed is something Google cares deeply about. And it's not just true of how things operate, but also how the user operates. So first thing I want to talk about is visual hierarchy. Computer science obviously focuses a lot on trees, the various algorithms you can apply on trees and B-trees and red-black trees and binary trees and all these various things and breadth-first search versus depth-first search. And actually, it doesn't just apply to computation. Like, obviously, if you're caching data, you want data that users access the most to be higher in the hierarchy, so you have, you know, least number of hops to get to it. Very common thing with computing, but also in terms of the interface, in terms of the visual search that people are going to do. So Gmail is actually a really good example of this. Let's look at your average Gmail inbox, where first thing right off the bat, the first branch point is read versus unread. Now, in this case, all the unread messages are grouped together. But even if they were kind of scattered, you can easily sort of visually select on how dark it is and just immediately at a glance, just kind of parsing it, see, immediately know which one's read versus unread versus some little tiny glyph that was indicating it. So that's the first branch point, which is a good one because it's one of the branch points that people often want to branch on, knowing if they're looking for something new that they thought might have come in versus something they know hasn't come in. The next branch point in the visual hierarchy is author versus message. And this is achieved not through contrast, but through spacing. So because you have a lot of space here, it's really easy to look at the author field versus the message field and have another branch point there. Then the final branch point is the subject versus the body of the message. And here this is less obvious because it's less important because we want to build that hierarchy. But you can also quickly differentiate the subject line versus the body because of that visual difference in the hierarchy. So here it's just spacing and contrast are being used to literally create this tree in terms of the order in which you're going to be able to scan stuff and how easy it is you're going to be able to scan things. So if you know you're looking for an unread message from a particular person, you have two hops, and you can get to it really fast. So that applies to the messages coming in. Also in terms of the interface itself, you have visual hierarchy. It's reasonably obvious looking at this what the most common control is. But just kind of dropping the color and the contrast a little bit, let's overlay some user metrics. I should note these are entirely fictional. I just made them up. But you can imagine user metrics look something like this, where you see more common controls, like compose, being interacted with a lot, and also their placement reflecting that. Then least common things, like more labels, rarely being interacted with. And this type of user metric starts to sort of, you can almost sort of see it when it's not there. In terms of the spacing and the order and the visual dominance of various controls. On mobile as well, you want to have, in primary UI, the controls that people are interacting with a lot, and then in secondary UI, the controls that they might occasionally interact with. So you can just pretty quickly look at the user metrics and create the visual hierarchy. But it's not just that. Also, from the visual hierarchy you create, you can actually kind of create the user metrics, because people are going to use stuff more if they find it. So it's really kind of circular, where you're both designing it and influencing them and their usage, and then their usage is influencing you as a designer in terms of how you want to expose stuff. So it's not purely like you could just have an algorithm that's just going to like feed the data in and stuff gets bigger, because you can actually influence the data itself. So diving into a couple other things, Fitt's law. Basically, this is solving for time given target size and distance. It's pretty straightforward. You have your target time, you have your distance. Device speed is like mouse speed, or if it's a touch interface, literally the speed of the person's arm. Device lag is if there's any number of milliseconds to actually process the event. Based off of this, you can find out that larger things that are closer, you can click on faster, which is pretty obvious. Hick's law is more interesting. It's about solving for time based off of the number of choices and probability. So this is actually, it's been proven that if you simplify the UI, people are going to be able to click on things faster. So the argument of, well, why don't we just introduce a button for that? It's because it has cost. Like, it literally makes the interface less efficient if people have to search against it. So equation here, you have the number of equally probable choices, which, first of all, no interface is going to have equal probabilities, so this form's bad. What you actually want is summation with the probability of each one individually. And based off of that, you can determine when you have something lined up with others, what the access time is going to be as people try to locate the one that they're looking for and choose. So the combination of things like Fitt's law and Hick's law goes into the field of cognitive modeling. And basically what this is predicting a performance assuming highly trained users. So unlike the self-describing section here, you're assuming that people know what everything is. And it's purely about access time and how quickly they can target the control and get to it. So a lot of this work is actually done at NASA Ames. There's a really good group doing it right next to the Google campus. And they're primarily doing it for fighter pilots, actually. This is a simulator of the F-35, and in this case, you obviously have really highly trained users because they know what every control does, and it's purely about visual access time and small controls and proximity to other small controls. But even for a standard interface, a mobile application or a desktop application, you could do this type of modeling to try to make sure things are super efficient looking at the metrics. So that's how to build great interfaces, but things we talked about, self-describing, basically, the user building a mental model, and sort of simulating in their head how stuff works, preventing errors, making users fast, the idea of cognitive modeling. But you know, that's how to make something really easy to use. Show an example. You know, this is really easy to use. If you know you have to get to the other side, you know, we talked about doors a bit. You know how to get there. You can assume the thing rotates being inside a circle. There's no mode errors because it only rotates in one direction. And you know, it's easy to use. It also looks like a human cheese slicer. It is not a happy door. So that leads us to the second part, which is visual design. Here's Christian Robinson.
So not to contradict you, but I think that the design of that is actually really quite appropriate. It communicates perfectly. Don't even think about going in me backwards. I will hurt you, mess you up. So Alex started out talking about users and how we can't blame users because it's not the stupid users. I'm gonna argue that users, in fact, are very smart. It's actually a hard problem to design a system that people can't figure out. Even think about things like cryptography or DRM or even code obfuscation, where it's difficult to create something that people can't reverse engineer. So if this is also true of UIs, then why are we here talking about making things easier? The reality is that people just don't care that much. If they care enough, they can figure things out. But in reality, they have a lot of things competing for their attention, whether it's all of the other apps in the App Store, all of the other sites that are going on, all of the TV shows, the watching Game of Thrones, The Bachelorette, both, and comparing, I don't know. So if something is really easy to use and people don't care, then it doesn't matter. So my argument is, if we do things to help people to care more, move over to the right, then even things that are very difficult, like learning how to drive a car, people are going to do it. Things that are really difficult, like riding a unicycle, and I know that some people care a lot about this, but in my case, I haven't cared enough to learn how to use it yet. Or something that's both easy and I care a lot about, like eating a sandwich is going to happen all the time. So the tricky part about this is that a good portion of these decisions that we make as what we're going to care about, what we don't care about, actually happen a lot below the conscious level. And this plays out in the kind of research that we do. It's actually pretty hard to find out what people care about. And if you ask them questions like, well, why do you like that? Or even, what do you like? People are really bad at giving answers. You get kind of garbage data back because we're not very good at even introspecting and knowing these things. So as designers, our job is to understand this and help people to make choices. Now, there's a lot that happens in this process, from when something hits our eyeballs to when it for the small percentage that hits the top of our reaches the top of our brains. So you may have had this experience in elementary school where the teacher told you that the eyes are not in fact at the top of the head. That the eyes are in the center of the head, and there was probably people in your class that argued, or in my case, I remember thinking, being the artist in the class, thinking that my eyes had betrayed me, or how could I have not seen this? It's so clear once you get the ruler out. And as it works out, there's a special unit of processing in our brain for facial recognition, and this is speculation on my part, but I think it's probably less important to the information from the eyebrows to the top of the head, and so our brain just kind of squishes it, and what we think we're seeing isn't really what we're seeing. This idea that design and these ideas of perception happen below consciousness aren't new. In fact, there are many people that have made this point that sometimes the best design is invisible design. It's a very famous essay on typography, famous for those of us who are really into typography. So, like, famous for a small subset. Where Beatrice Ward makes a case that good typography should be like a crystal goblet that's transparent, that you can't see it. You see the content inside, but the glass is doing its job best when it's almost not there. So a bunch of psychologists at the beginning of the last century, see a lot of people doing this, recognizing a failure in my position of the text there. A bunch of scientists at the beginning of the last century wanted to figure this out. There were a bunch of Germans. They wanted to figure out how to order things and group things and how we do that. They called this idea of order, they considered it order or rightness. They called it Gestalt. Now here's an example of some Gestalt principles at work. You can see here how some very simple changes in the structure of the data make it so much easier to process on the right. Alex talked about these hierarchies of information and how since we can't change the algorithms in people's brains, we have to speed things up by structuring the data. Well, these Gestalt principles are how we structure the data. Now, I'm not going to go through all of the principles here. I'd recommend that you read the Wikipedia article on the topic. It's great. I could have just read it and done well. But I've distilled some of these ideas into two practical principles that you can put to work immediately when you're evaluating designs. Here's the first one. This is the thing that I wish that people had told me on the very first day of design school. It's line stuff up. That's it. Everything should be lined up with something, unless it has a good reason not to. So even if elements are at the very opposite sides of the screen and they're almost aligned, line them up. If we don't do it, then our subconscious brains are spending precious cycles trying to figure out, why are those things not lined up? Does it mean something? Does it not mean something? It's almost like I'd compare it to a memory leak in your software where, you know, something's going on, you're not exactly sure, but you're wasting your resources. Let's line that back up. It's better. So even stuff that isn't on the same screen, let's say three or four screens later, you've got something that's, you know, maybe in this case a little bit above halfway down the page. Line it up. Even though it doesn't seem like people will be able to make that association, and consciously they certainly won't, our visual processing systems are using that information to know how to decode this. Now, I might also point out, if you do want to bring emphasis to something, then not lining it up is a really great way to do it. You can see in these suggested paragraphs right here how just pulling one line out of alignment gives you a bunch of information about what's the most important in a lot of structure. Okay, here's a second big idea. Design the spaces. Now, this is a little bit hard to do because, again, our conscious brain is really good at examining objects in the foreground. Backgrounds tend to be less important once we've actually picked out the objects. But if we're designing the experience, it's important for us to help people do that, pick out the groups in the foreground. One of the ways we do that is by looking at the spaces in between things. Our subconscious brains are constantly parsing our field of view, looking at the spaces between things. And when things are the same, have the same amount of space between them, we very easily and very quickly just rest. We check that off. Those things are grouped together. Those things make sense. In the case where every element on the screen has slightly different spacing, again, our subconscious brains are wasting cycles. We're in our massively parallel processing brain, there's, you know, billions of threads that are just in infinite loops, trying to figure out what's going on. And in the best case, maybe we'll still be able to parse it. In the worst case, we'll just kind of discount it as noise, and we won't understand the intended structure. So design the spaces. Likewise, using bigger spaces is a great way to break things up. You could talk about white space, but. So this is especially true in typography. This is kind of a typographer's curse. Once you see kerning, you kind of can't unsee it, and you'll constantly be looking at, you know, every time you see a V and an A, you're like, did they kern that? Did they? The idea is letters don't, just the squares that the letters are drawn in don't naturally fit together, so you have to sometimes push them together. In the case of type designer, spend many hours looking at all of the possible combinations and straightening them out. Okay, so the very last Gestalt principle says something like, people can also order things based on past experience, which is a very short way of kind of discounting the whole rest of design. And it turns out that this is really one of the biggest and hardest parts. All of style and culture and all of these things fit in this very last principle. If you look at this right here, you can see some of these, you know, these spacing and grouping principles can help me to understand, you know, maybe make this number easier to parse. But if you've ever called somebody in the U.S. or looked up something in an address book, you know immediately that this is a format for a phone number, right? It's not because of the spacing. It's because of these kind of learned ideas. We have a lot of these, and they're hard to deal with because they're kind of vague. The associations aren't super crisp always. And here's an example of that. Let's consider for a moment a grocer that wants to communicate to everybody that her produce is extremely fresh, and wanting to put her best foot forward, she commissions a sign, and she hires an expensive designer, and they make it out of chrome and neon, and she thinks, good, now people will always know that the produce here is fresh. Now, contrast that with a grocer across the street who doesn't really think about it too much, but all of her produce that comes fresh from the farm, just like the one across the street, comes in these cardboard boxes. She cuts out pieces of the boxes and just scrawls fresh peaches on. Now, which of these two design systems conveys fresh peaches? Right? This is a good example of the idea that better isn't always better. That when you're communicating something, that these vague associations that people have can be a very strong cue. And so as product designers, we always have to be asking this question. What associations are people going to make from what they're looking at here? Which is, it sometimes seems absurd looking at, you know, a simple web form thinking, what associations are people going to make with this thing? What does this look like? So we, in these design processes, this is one exercise that we do, and I would highly recommend it. It's not hard to get started. Just pull up a whole bunch of imagery and start sorting out on the table. Start making these associations. What should our product feel like? What does our product feel like right now? What do our competitors' products look like? What things do we need to? What associations do we need to evoke in the minds of our users? Okay, so now we're talking about how to make people care. There's one last idea I want to put out there. One of the best ways to make people care about our products is to show people that we care about our products. Now, this is a reality about perception that's hardwired into our brains, that sometimes very small things can make a really big difference in how we see something. Now, I don't know whether... Whether if I download an app that has a poorly executed app icon, whether it's going to be more flaky or whether it's going to crash on me, I haven't necessarily seen the data with that correlation. But I do know that that's the association that users are going to make based on millions of years of evolution. When you see something that's not quite the right color or that has a hole in the wrong place, you bite that fruit, you might be seeing the second half of a worm. So also, we need to not miss the opportunities to do the things that we don't have to. Those little pieces of design in places that where they're not needed, where they're uncalled for, tell the user that, hey, a designer was here. Somebody thought about this. They're like little love notes for our users. It's like the interactive doodle on the homepage or the mint on the pillow, what you put on the back of the box and the package. It's the hidden extra level in a game. There's value in doing these things that don't have an apparent commercial purpose, where we're showing people that we care, so that they'll care enough to use our products. In this case, Pac-Man didn't help people to finish their searches faster. It probably actually got in the way for some people, me included. But people loved it, and why? Because we didn't have to do it. It's like a note or flowers. It's these intangibles that show people that we care. Here's another small example that comes from Google Now. where the context header changes based on your time of day or your location. And when we were making these, people asked, during the process, people said, well, this is going to be hard. We're going to have to draw a lot of cities, and we're going to have to draw a lot of states. That's kind of difficult. And the answer was, yes, that's the point. That it's these little pieces and these little touches that don't necessarily have a practical purpose that demonstrate to people that, hey, if they thought that much about this, then think about how much work they put into the actual search results. Now, you have to be careful with this because it's a very, very strong message to send. You have to make sure that your product backs it up. So how do we apply this to thinking to products? Well, it doesn't have to be the large things. The Pac-Man example, the effort to actually make the game was a lot smaller than to produce the search results. But simply ask yourself this question: what are the things that I can do that I don't have to? So that's it. Here's a couple. Pieces of reading that we recommend you look into to find out more about some of these topics, like affordances and natural mapping in Don Norman's book, or the mental models in Alan Cooper's classic About Face. And for typography and layout, one of my favorites is the elements of typographic style.
Thank you.